Good evening. I'm Gerald Duff, and as Vice President and Dean of the College, I welcome you to Rhodes College West. For the second time in a matter of weeks, we are indebted to our friends of Evergreen Presbyterian Church for graciously allowing us to use their pulpit again for tonight's distinguished guest lecturer in this inaugural series of Rhodes's Lillian and Maury Moss Endowment for the Visual Arts. The overwhelming success of the college's new program is evidenced by outreaches such as this one, a response we are simply unable to accommodate on our campus. I'd like you to join me in recognizing the man whose generosity makes all this possible for Rhodes College and for the people of Memphis, Mr. Maury Moss. Mr. Moss? The reason, of course, for this enthusiasm and for your presence here tonight is the stature of our renowned guest, experts at the pinnacle of their professions, exemplified by our speaker tonight, Robert A.M. Stern. Principal in the award-winning firm of Robert A.M. Stern Associates, Mr. Stern is a noted architect, teacher, and writer. In 1984, he was the recipient of the Medal of Honor of the New York chapter of the American Institute of Architects. He also was among the architects selected to represent the United States at the Venice Biennial in both 1976 and 1980. In 1982, he was the subject of a one-man exhibition at the Neuberger Museum of the State University of New York at Purchase. As author, Robert Stern's works include New Directions in American Architecture and George Howe Toward a Modern American Architecture. He is also co-author of East Hampton's Heritage, an Illustrated Architectural Record, and New York 1900. Among the exhibitions he has arranged are 40 Under 40, Young Talent in Architecture, and Suburbs at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in 1981. As teacher, Mr. Stern is professor of architecture at Columbia University, and in 1984 was appointed the first director of Columbia's Temple Hoyne Buell Center for the Study of American Architecture. Of current interest to us all is the 8-part television documentary, Pride of Place, Building the American Dream, hosted by Robert Stern. The series, which airs Monday, beginning March 24th, locally on WKNO, reflects the perspective of Robert Stern as he talks to fellow architects, historians, developers, and critics, highlighting the differences among thinkers and practitioners of American architecture. That is a treat we will share with the nationwide television public. Tonight, we have the man to ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Robert Stern.
Thank you. I'm delighted. This is my first time lecturing in a church. It's absolutely the only thing I will do in the future. I demand it. I want to thank Mr. Moss for making such a series possible. I had no idea when I accepted this invitation that I was to be in the first heat and that I was to follow my friend Robert Hughes, whom I admire enormously. And I gather he was very controversial. I hope I won't disappoint his memory, and I hope I'll be equally controversial. Certainly, in any case, Mr. Moss and I are going to work out a deal at the end. We're going to pass the plate, and we're splitting the proceeds. These lectures are very expensive. I also, before speaking to the subject in a more direct way, want to say how pleased I am to be in Memphis, a place I have never been before. And a place which, in all my jaded New York friends said, "Oh, you're going there." And I have to confess that downtown they were right. But Rhodes College, on the other hand, has been an absolute thrill to me. I mean, I think that downtown, it's a gratuitous remark from the visiting fireman, but you wonderful Memphis architects and other people whom I've met with such pleasure tonight had better get to work seriously about downtown. It is not full of pride of place, and it should be. But Rhodes College is a dream for someone like me beyond all expectations. the architect Charles Clauder, who designed it in the 20s and has worked on other places like St. Paul's and Yale, which I know very well, never had the privilege of having his ideas carried out with such splendor and so consistently for 50 or more years, a dream any architect has and any architect of his talent deserves. And I think all those people at Rhodes College who have supported that vision, that dream of that place, all these years are to be commended. And they, in my view, and it sounds slightly corny, but it isn't meant to be, it truly exemplify exactly what I had in mind when I put together this series. American architecture is capable of making wonderful places and holding to the values of those places. We are a society made up of forms and people and traditions that come from all over the world. It's a fantasy that we wish to hold, but is not truly so, that we are a unique culture. We are not a unique culture the way French or English or the Chinese or Japanese are, have grown over millennia in one place. We are all immigrants or sons or granddaughters or great-great-greats, but finally we assign our cultural values to ourselves here in this place and to places where we came from. Rhodes College, fantastic idea of making a cloistered Gothic environment which speaks about colleges and speaks about the academic world and about the need to find a place apart from the hustle and bustle of the city to contemplate. And it does it beautifully with incredible taste and beautiful materials. And it carries out that vision over a long period of time because that vision is much greater than any of our individual contributions could be. It is a continuity of culture that is expressed there, and how fitting for a college and how beautiful and inspiring it was to me to see it this afternoon, and I look forward to my return visit tomorrow morning. So saying, I think that the urgent task that we all have as citizens is to bring that same love back to our cities, to the centers of our cities. We had it once in the 19th century. We had the City Beautiful movement where we rebuilt some of our cities on magnificent scale. Cleveland, Washington, D.C. was recreated in 1900 to the form you now know it. San Francisco and a host of others. Memphis is just awaits the uncorking of that same vision. And if I could leave anything with you tonight, I hope it would be the enthusiasm to do that, which means that all architects and clients and citizens alike have to unite behind one grand conception for a place above the fray and the arguments of daily life if you want to make Memphis a place that my smarmy friends in New York won't say ooh to in there. And that's what it's all about. We each of us have to have the responsibility of creating our own homes, our own hometowns, our colleges or whatever, to be good enough, as the architect Charles Moore says, to put on postcards. Now I've escalated. Your city has to be good enough to be put on television. With those words, I'd like to turn to the first slides, please, if we can have the lights out. As I tried to suggest in these prefatory remarks, which were from the heart, even though maybe a little hard to take for some people, is that America is a civilization that grew up from other civilizations. We are the first modern country. And what I would like to do tonight is to give you some of the themes of the television program in a broad and short version. I believe the program needs to be seen in and of itself, and then if I'm lucky, I'll be invited back and we can debate the ideas. And then beyond that, I'd like to show you some of my own work as an architect, because I've found in traveling around the country for the program and making the programs that, of course, it reaffirmed and confused my own views at once of how you make architecture, or how I make architecture, which is all I can talk about. The programs are a personal view of American architecture. They're neither history nor Pollyanna-ish endorsements, but they are my take on American architecture. And therefore, tonight you will get that a bit and my take on architecture as an architect. In any case, If we were in Europe, if this was an audience of French or Italian or Russians or whatever, we could talk about the local traditions of architecture which go beyond time almost, that go back before recorded history, that grow up out of the relationship of the place to the materials that you could find in the quarries and in the earth that made the color of the clay that makes the roof tiles. We could talk about a simple way of building over time, over years, decades, centuries even. We could talk about a place like Portofino in Italy, which grows up over these long periods of time and has a common thread of meaning and of visual form. We call that the vernacular, the architecture of the everyday, just as English or French or Spanish is a vernacular language. It's the everyday language of culture. The vernacular did not exist in America when the settlers arrived here, except for a handful of buildings in the Southwest by the American Indians there. The rest of the native population was building a kind of nomadic architecture, an impermanent architecture. So we had no vernacular when we were first settled in the 16th century. We had no great tradition of a learned architecture. Vernacular is really about building, ordinary building as ordinary language. Architecture with a capital A, in the Western tradition at least, is really classical architecture, as represented by the Roman Forum and as represented by the buildings that were built since the Renaissance, reviving and extending the language of classical architecture as the Romans had taken it from the Greek and as it went back to Egypt, and I suppose, as I was reminded in a conversation before, to Memphis. So it all comes back in that way. But classical architecture does go back to the earliest civilizations of Mesopotamia and Egypt. It is the great learned architecture. And it has many values for us in America today, as it has had since we became the United States, and since Jefferson introduced it into our architecture. And I'll talk about that in a bit. But let me say a few things about classical architecture to set our terms straight. It is, of course, a high language with real rules, a grammar and a syntax and a complicated vocabulary, just as Latin or Greek might have. Does have, and many of you may have studied it. It is a language that transcends an individual culture as it has evolved and has become somewhat international. It is associated with the great public institutions of man in the West, with the idea of democracy or imperial power, or both. It has many meanings, but it has to do with the authority of the institutions of man. It is a language also which has made up of a series of elements, the column, the beam, the intercolumniation, that is the spacing between the columns, which are human-oriented in their organization. The column is the architectural representation of man, a human being, standing. We talk of fields of columns or forests of columns, more precisely. We talk of forests of columns so that the column also has a relationship to the tree. The classical column with its ornament and its system of the orders, Ionic, Doric, what have you, has a natural relationship. The carving of those orders, the introduction of flowers, acanthus leaves, egg and dart in the United States, later corn cob capitals, and what have you, is a way of making architecture, that most inert, seemingly, and abstract of our arts, into something extremely alive and natural in its character. Now, the interaction between the grand classical architecture and the local traditions, the vernacular, is what architecture is about. In the great public places, in traditional architecture, classicism was usually played quite straight without reference to local place, because the great cities, Rome or whatever, had to have their own existence independent of the local factionalism. But in the small towns and villages of Europe and elsewhere where classical architecture has held sway, it interacted with the vernacular. just as Latin became corrupted and emerged as French or Spanish, and ultimately a further corruption to become English, and became rich and distinct. So you had a sense of individual place and grand traditions. That concept of the interrelationship between the great themes of classical architecture and the local traditions was fundamental to American architecture from the very beginning, when the Spanish first settled in America. You know, we have two or three major themes of settlement in the United States and this continent. One is the New England settlement, which most of us as a culture as a whole, certainly those of us with an Anglo orientation, obviously face, but it was by no means the first settlement. We also have a French tradition, which is probably most familiar to you in this part of this country, which didn't really thrive because of political conditions, although in Louisiana, of course, it's very strong. And we have the Spanish tradition, which the force of events in the last 50 or 60 years has come to mean more and more, as it should. But the Spaniards who colonized America colonized it as an absolute extension of the power of Europe. It was not that they were running against the power, but they were bringing it as an iteration of that power. And so when the great missions were built in California, they were an expression of the authority of the Spanish church and the Spanish monarchy. You see Santa Barbara on the screen, the great square in front of it. It is the grandest of the missions, which combines exactly, for my purposes, the textbook-like qualities of the theme I'm trying to suggest. It is both a vernacular building. The Native Americans worked under the priests to build the building out of the clay and mud and adobe that they could put together there, the wood that they could get in the forest. But the great pediment in the front, the temple, and indeed the towers of the church on the side, are of course expressions, one of Europe, of Rome, the center of Catholic life at the time, and beyond that, the ancient world of the Romans and the Greeks, so that it goes back in time and carries that classical idea forward as an iteration of power and authority and the nobility of man at its highest level of thought and of organization. Now, once the power of the church eroded and the power of the Spanish government eroded, that tradition became more and more vernacular. So that by the 1840s, as Anglo-Americans moved across the continent to California and the Spanish were forced back and further into Mexico, the tradition remained in these buildings like in Monterey, where you have a kind of combination of New England architecture, the shingled roofs, the sort of low scale, and the Spanish tradition of the great colonnade, the arcade of a town or a square has now become almost like an American or New England porch, very thin in wood, but the memory is there, and you get what we call ranch house architecture or what have you. We get a hybrid, a new vernacular emerges that bespeaks a region and a particular interplay between two cultures that in Europe had nothing to do with each other except as enemies, that is the Spanish and the English. Now, the English who came here, and I needn't remind you, but I will remind you anyhow, that nobody has ever come to America because they were doing all that well back home. We are here because things weren't going right for our grandparents or great-great-great-grandparents back in the old country, wherever it might have been. We came as a culture with a few knapsacks and memories. The English who settled first in Jamestown didn't quite work out, but really permanent settlement was established in Plymouth. You see the reconstruction of Plymouth Plantation here, brought with them the medieval, super modest architecture they knew back in England. It was all they knew of how to build the new Jerusalem on American soil. First, they built out of wattle and daub and straw because that's how they had built in England. Then they discovered that there was plenty of wood here as opposed to England, so they could fell trees, and they gradually turned to shingles and clapboarding and all the elements of the New England vernacular, which has become so pervasive in America. But let us face it, 200 years later, or 120 years, or 80 years later, when the Declaration of Independence was declared, Americans didn't want to have anything to do with this colonial background. One, because they didn't want to be reminded of the fact that they, a new nation, gathered together for the first time in the history of man, not out of anything else but a will to act. A piece of paper binds our nation. Not a god, and in 1776, not even a government. Just a will to be independent of something else, the Declaration of Independence. And they didn't want to be reminded of it because it was English in particular. And if you were an English-speaking culture, and you wanted to set yourself apart from that England that you have just gone to war against, the last thing you want to be reminded of is the kind of buildings you built that were basically English in America. Now, that tendency had already existed all through the 18th century, even before the Declaration. That is the first part of it. Just as soon as our forefathers had two nickels together, they immediately took those old houses that we think are so charming today and tried to cover them up. Just like any of us, when we get a little money, we immediately try to rewrite our own personal histories and make us sound like we always came from the chips. It's a very interesting American phenomenon. Here in Medford, Massachusetts, about 3 miles north of Boston, you have the Isaac Royal House, so aptly named. Mr. Royal had a grand name. And you will see here the windows gathered together to suggest great columns along the front. You'll see a brick front, the chimneys in the fashionable Palladian manner at the ends. But if you examine, as archaeologists have, the actual construction of that house, you will see that buried within that house is an old salt box. And as soon as the royal family and its other families of owners got two nickels together, as I've said, they immediately encased this modest little dwelling, which was nasty and horrible, let's face it, and cold and damp and awful, and the kids were all screaming and they were having just horrible, into something grand and expansive, and covered their tracks like mad. The problem for the first Americans, that is the first United States of Americans, was that even this image was wrong because it was English. It was a suburban or provincial version of the great English country houses. No one understood that more clearly than Thomas Jefferson, who we were very blessed. We had an architect in power at the early days of our country. Perhaps things would look better. If I don't go up for election in this church, I might take on Washington. Who knows how these things go? In any case, Thomas Jefferson, when he was still in France as our minister plenipotentiary, sent back drawings and a model to Virginia, which was relocating from colonial Williamsburg to a new capital in the western part of the state called Richmond, which was a mercantile capital and would have nothing to do with the old power system. He said, we must build a classical world. He picked classical architecture for very simple reasons. In order to go Roman classical architecture, to go behind the intrigues and the culture of Western Europe, which he felt England was part of and that the new nation had to divorce itself from, the way to do it was to go back in time to such an ancient period, to the ancients, and to assign to that ancient culture values that he felt were appropriate to America. Greece was a democracy. It had slaves. We had slaves. Rome was an empire made up of people from all different places and different languages. It was a polyglot empire. Already, the United States was clearly a polyglot empire in 1776. America was an empire, a great continent, a vast nation to be yet to be created. Jefferson talked of the American continent as the American Continental Democratic Empire. And he, in the capital of Virginia, which you see here, the central building is his design, he had no problem in designing that, of packing a lot of offices and a lot of bureaucratic stuff into that image of a temple. the temple, which had been dedicated to the gods of ancient world, had sometimes served as churches in the 17th and 18th century in England and in Rome and in France and in England. In Jefferson's mind, Jefferson's will was transmogrified once more to become a place for democratic enterprise. Jefferson also understood that every American would have to build his own house to mark a claim on the continent. Jefferson, of course, was obsessed by architecture. He was an amateur of the highest standing in architecture. He himself said had all his pleasure was building and tearing down Monticello. He had started building it before the Revolution as an 18th century Palladian English style house. He tore it all down, basically, rebuilt it as a Roman temple. The family would be placed, the gods or religion, as the focus of American life. This is a temple to the family. It's a temple to the individual. It's an autobiography. Our houses, and to some extent each and every one of our important buildings, is the autobiography of some individual who had the will to build something in his or her image. And it takes its place above the site. The servants are suppressed below. Jefferson was very ambivalent on the question of slavery, as you know, but he did keep the servants below, at least, as if to say, well, if I must have them, I don't really want to acknowledge it, which was already the first step, it could be argued, toward a more radical solution to the problem. And finally, Jefferson, at the end of his life, the thing he wished to be remembered for more than any other, except the writing of the Declaration of Independence, was the creation of the University of Virginia, in which this place, the most American of places to most foreigners who visit this country, is not American at all. It's a series of houses along the mall, which is a great court of honor. Each house for a faculty member, those of you who are academics in the audience certainly can appreciate that. Each one gets his own temple along the side. They're all connected. The students are properly kept in the ranges, which are basically where in a classical world would be the little shops and artisanal houses. And then at the center of that lawn, commanding it all, he borrows the form of the great Roman building, the Pantheon, which was built as a temple to many gods by the Romans, which was then used as a Christian church in Rome and in the 17th century, 18th century, and which he takes out the religion and makes into a secular building. He builds it at half size, and he fills it with books, because he's saying in the new continent it is learning that will conquer the continent. He makes this classical world out of the materials of the local place, wood, not marble, brick molded on the site practically, or in the nearby countryside. And he builds each of those temples as a model for architectural excellence. So every student at the university will not only study the languages and the sciences, but will study architecture, so that those students can go out and build a classical world across America. Jefferson's vision has haunted and thrilled and really dominated America. He's understood the need to make buildings as autobiographies, the need to make buildings as statements of ideals, and the need for a classical architecture to unite the nation as one, because there are too many vernaculars at work otherwise. That idea of the house as temple pervades American architecture and is one major theme, and one which, as an architect, of course, those of you who may know my work know that I have been very much involved with, because I have done many houses. Alexander Jackson Davis in the 1840s, when he designed his many villas, which influenced for a new emerging middle class the whole suburbanization of this country, as his American farmhouse, his ultimate American house. He uses that form of the temple, even though he modifies it with elements from Swiss vernacular, kind of the bracketed architecture of the Swiss countryside, even though he introduces a porch that's asymmetrical. asymmetrical and doesn't use the classical orders, but in fact cast iron columns, which have cast iron tendrils upon them, and so on. Nonetheless, the fundamental type of the house as the temple is part of Davis's thinking.